This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with the author of Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America.
Nancy McClain puts it all together. This is like a evolving coup that's going on now. The bad guys are halfway there.
CIA expert Douglas Valentine joins us to talk about his recent book, The CIA as Organized Crime.
The subtitle of his book is How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. You read his book and you'll see it sure does.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Over time, the GOP has been transformed into an operation conducting a concerted effort to curb democratic rule in favor of capitalist interests in every branch of the government, whatever the consequences. It is marching ever closer to the ultimate goal of reshaping our Constitution to protect moneyed interests. This gradual takeover of a major political party happened steadily over several decades and often in plain sight. Duke Professor Nancy McClain exposes the architecture of this change and its ultimate aim. She has written that, quote, both my research and my observations as a citizen lead me to believe American democracy is in peril. Her book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, has become an intellectual flashpoint and caused her to become the victim of a coordinated right-wing attack. She tells the long-overlooked story of James Buchanan, the political economist who developed the playbook for Charles Koch and his brother and their web of billionaires and millionaires who, beginning in the mid-2000s, have become a force to reckon with. To talk about the subversion of our democratic system from within is Professor Nancy McClain.
Nancy McClain, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
The Republican Party has been transformed both locally and nationally. It's no longer the party that, as you wrote, my father used to vote for. Today we're hoping to explore how the Republican Party has become an instrument of the far right. You argue that key to this story, what you call the missing piece, is understanding the rise of the billionaire radical right and its radical impact on our politics. There's a man named James McGill Buchanan. Tell us about him and how you learned about him.
Yes, well, what I learned is that James McGill Buchanan's ideas are what enabled Charles Koch to break through in his quest for radical transformation of our institutions after decades of pretty much ineffectual work on the margins. James McGill Buchanan was the first Nobel Prize winner to have been born in the U.S. South and to have worked most of his life in Southern institutions. He was the founder of one of the co-founders of a new school of thought called public choice economics, which is actually a broader tradition that includes people like Cass Sunstein, who worked for President Obama, and others. But his particular variant of that public choice school was the Virginia School of Political Economy, and he was always preoccupied with critiquing democracy as it existed in his early years, and then ultimately with prescribing measures by which it could be, in his words, enchained. And it was those ideas that Charles Koch picked up.
And what did Koch do to fund Buchanan? Can you talk a bit about the network of organizations and think tanks that Koch has set up?
Yes. Well, Koch, for years, was the single biggest funder on the radical libertarian right by a long stretch. So anybody who was on the libertarian right and looking for money went to Charles Koch. Now, James Buchanan, from his first years in Virginia in the late 1950s, had also broader corporate backing from some of the corporations often associated with the radical anti-New Deal right, you know, some of the fossil fuel companies, General Electric, and so forth. But by the late 1990s, 1997 in particular, Koch had become very frustrated with the inability of his minoritarian cause to make progress. And so he began to invest in a big way in Buchanan's center at the George Mason University. And since then, the center at George Mason has become the kind of academic base camp of this radical right. So the economics department there, something called the Mercatus Center, and the now renamed Scalia School of Law are all important components in the Koch-backed effort to transform the country. And they've actually become pipeline, and Koch asked for this. He wanted a kind of talent pipeline. He always said that their greatest problem was the shortage of talent. And so what they're doing is setting up institutions, little training centers at various other schools modeled on this George Mason case, where they churn out and train young operatives to go off and staff the various pieces of the apparatus, which now is huge. I mean, it is literally dozens and dozens of organizations, actually hundreds if you take into account all the affiliates of the State Policy Network and the international affiliates of something called the Atlas Network. So this is a huge operation, larger than either political party, and quite determined to affect radical change in our country.
What is Koch, you know, who I think you write is the seventh most wealthy person in America, what is Koch and his cohorts, what is their vision of a future society?
Well, it's very interesting what they say when they're trying to put their vision out popularly. Is they talk a lot about liberty. They sometimes even now call themselves the freedom movement. They talk about limited government and low taxes. But if you actually look at the works that most influenced Koch in his construction of that vision, and you look at what some of the people say in their own words our country would look like after success, what you see is an America that would be unrecognizable to your listeners. It's a place in which the three functions of government are maintaining the national defense, overseeing the rule of law, and ensuring social order. And beyond that, we are individually responsible for all of our needs. So ultimately, in their dream world, we have no Social Security, we have no Medicare, we have no public education. What we have instead is a great pressure for us to save as soon as we are sentient beings for our own future needs. And if we fail to save and fail to provide for them, then tough luck. We will be examples to others of what happens when you do not save. And I think you're seeing an enactment, if you will, of this vision in the discussion over health care. And, you know, Americans of both parties are wondering why it is that the Senate is, you know, rushing to push through the repeal of Obamacare and it held, you know, they've had different incarnations, but basically proposed policies that don't get more than 20% support in any poll. Usually it's about 12. They don't have majority support in any state in the country. And it's horrible in the view of most Americans. And yet the donor class is putting pressure on these Republican politicians to make them toe the line or they will face a primary challenge, and forcing them to vote for something that their own constituents don't want. So it's actually gone so far, this transformation of the Republican Party into a delivery vehicle, that that party is pushing through the agenda of its wealthiest, most extreme right donor class rather than it's the voters whose support it needs to continue as a political party.
Well, they've targeted the state. Trump's main advisor, Steve Bannon, has said that he wants to destroy the state. One of his allies, Grover Norquist, famously said that he wants to shrink the government down to the size that it's so small that it can be drowned in a bathtub. What is their strategy to take down the liberal state?
Well, that is where Buchanan's ideas came in. And whereas other people in this, you know, some of your listeners might refer to them as neoliberal, others free market fundamentalists, whereas others in that milieu, like Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek, concentrated more on making the case for free markets, James Buchanan spent his career making the case against government and basically trying to take down, in his words, the understanding of public interest that prevailed at mid-century. The idea that all politicians should be seeking the public interest and all political actors, and then we'd try to persuade one another of our case for what that public interest was. And Buchanan instead looked at the incentives in politics And so he focused particularly on how different groups made demands on public officials, or, you know, also corporations made demands on public officials and elected officials, and those elected officials, in his terms, would have a self-interest in re-election, so that they would try to, you know, appease multiple constituencies without worrying about the cost. And so he did have a very original interpretation of where deficits came from. Now, what the Koch team has done is taken his ideas and turned them into a strategy for kind of retrofitting American government. So the first part of that is to break down all the progressive groups that made demands on the state that would lead to taxation and any transfer of resources from one, you know, section of the population to another. So you know, all the radical attacks we've seen on unions in the last few years fall into this pattern. They're also attacking the American Association of Retirement People and trying to stir young people up against older people to say older people are getting money as they shouldn't. So lots of efforts to break up groups. Also to privatize public resources and services. So they want to privatize ultimately social, in the name, you know, they're saying reform, but they're not questioned about what they mean about that. But what they really ultimately want is the privatization of Social Security and Medicare, public lands, all the rest. And they want to do a whole series of radical policy changes that we probably don't have time for, but the key thing to know is they also want to lock those changes into constitutional amendments, both at the state level and the federal level. So they're actually pushing toward a constitutional convention, which we have not seen in this country since 1787, achieve what the donor class would like to achieve and cannot achieve through the regular political process. And they've actually been extremely successful in gaining control of state governments. They now have full control over 25 states, both houses of the legislature and the governorship. And they're using those states to, in a sense, kind of trap the federal government and prevent the federal government from enacting workable progressive reforms, as they did with the Affordable Care Act, with not accepting Medicaid expansion. So it's a pretty radical vision. It's extremely strategic. And I argue in the book that you can't understand this strategy or its code without understanding the ideas of this guy, James McGill Buchanan.
Nancy, you made the statement that, quote, both my research and my observations as a citizen lead me to believe American democracy is in peril. Can you talk a bit about that? And is that why you wrote this wonderful book?
Yes. I feel like, in some ways, you know, all of what I've been saying kind of points to that conclusion that our democracy is in peril. You know, you can see this in many ways. I mean, I live in North Carolina now, one of the states that has been a laboratory for this, and it has just been utterly, radically transformed by this cause. And we could also point to things that we haven't talked about yet, like the extreme voter suppression bills, which they also want to lock into the Constitution at a constitutional convention. Voter suppression, extreme gerrymandering, refusal to abide by customary procedures in terms of transparency and full disclosure and proper hearings and so forth. It is just such a radical vision. And, you know, I know maybe some of your listeners will think that I am, you know, Chicken Little or something, you know, and that it couldn't possibly be that bad. And there I just have to say that as I was researching this book, so often I would just discover another wing of this, a deeper set of connections, and literally feel nausea, you know, as I was going through the sources or, you know, going through these websites, just at the scope of this thing. It is huge, and it is very determined, it is very strategic, and I don't think people on the left adequately understand that at all. There's too much mocking of Trump's tweets and his foibles and his intelligence and so forth when this thing is really, really moving forward, and moving forward at an incredible pace in his administration while people are focused on his tweets and, again, his foibles. So, yes, I absolutely wrote this book as I did, in the way that I did, and in the speed that I did, because I really believe that we are at one of those forks in the roads that will determine what kind of society we will be for the next several generations. It is, in my mind, akin to the Civil War and Reconstruction, to the Great Depression of the 1930s to the struggles of the 1960s, you know, whether the forces who believe in robust and inclusive democracy will come through this stronger, or whether those who believe in restricting the electorate, that democracy is a danger to private property, and that we need a more actually harsh government, whether they will succeed is, we can't know right now. It will all depend on what people do. But I will say the single most important lesson that I hope that people take from reading my book is that this cause, this Koch-backed libertarian cause, is doing what it's doing in the ways that it's doing it because they know from repeated experience that they will never persuade a majority of their views. And so they have to go at it in this side way, what Koch has called the technology of transformation. And I think that if the vast majority of Americans understood what this cause wants, and if they understand what it wants and they reactivate their kind of civic institutions, turn off their electronics and commit to the political process, then I think that this cause will be defeated because, again, it is a small minority, but it's an extremely wealthy and determined and ideological minority.
We've been speaking with Nancy McLean, a professor at Duke, who wrote the terrific book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America. Nancy, I can't tell you how grateful Heidi and I are for your good work on this, and we're so pleased to be able to interview you. I wanted to ask you about Gloria Steinem had observed after Trump was elected and put all these people into cabinet positions, all these far-right people. She said that he found a fox for every chicken coop.
And, that's a brilliant quote.
And that's certainly true. And I wanted your reaction to the nature of the cabinet and how it relates to the Koch project.
Yes. That is just a perfect quote and vintage Steinem, and it really captures the situation. There is actually less light, I think, between the Koch operations and the Trump administration than we've been led to believe. At the very minimum, he is looking to them for so many of his top appointments. The people who are in pivotal places come out of these, not out of the mainstream of the Republican Party, to the extent that there is a mainstream anymore, but what they would call the Republican establishment. But rather out of these Koch-led operations, which I said, you know, there are now, you know, dozens and dozens of these, but there are some particularly key ones, and those key ones have supplied many of Trump's senior leaders. By one researcher's calculation, about 70% of Trump's senior appointees come from these Koch operations, are veterans of it. So that's a pretty stunning figure for what was once a kind of a marginal part of the political spectrum. But they include certainly Mike Pence, his vice presidential candidate, who's deeply rooted in these operations. They include Mark Short, who is his the White House liaison to Congress, who's a key pivot person for legislation, and he actually comes out of Freedom Partners, which was the, you know, is the big dark money operation that the Koch, you know, donor network that the Kochs have run. So he knows very well what the donors want, and presumably can convey that to Congress. Who else? Scott Pruitt at the EPA is deeply, you know, involved, has been deeply involved in these Koch operations, and particularly their, you know, fossil fuel protection work and efforts to prevent any action on climate change. Even Mike Pompeo, the head of the CEO, comes out of these Kansas operations. Certainly Chris Kobach, who's directing the new voter suppression effort. I mean, the list just goes on and on. It is really, really striking how many key people. Mick Mulvaney, the budget director, is another one. So this is really an administration that is, in many ways, I would say, other than perhaps the president himself, a dream administration for the Kochs to achieve their agenda. Oh, and you mentioned Steve Bannon before and his desire to, as he puts it, deconstruct the administrative state. Well, somebody who represents that project in the Scalia School of Law at George Mason, Naomi Rao, was just named to a key agency that most citizens won't pay attention to but is extremely important for regulation, and that is the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, OIRA. So, yes, there is definitely a fox presiding over every chicken coop.
Nancy,
and Betsy DeVos, we didn't even talk about her.
Nancy, speaking of dark money, a number of reviewers have placed your book as the companion to Jane Mayer's Dark Money. Do you think this is accurate?
Well, I'm honored by the comparison. Jane Mayer has done hugely important work as a journalist for the American people in first drawing our attention to the Koch brothers in her articles for The New Yorker some years ago. She wrote a brilliant article about my own state, North Carolina, called State for Sale, that focused on the Koch partner, Art Pope, who has led the effort within North Carolina. And her book is terrific at just, you know, showing readers that money trail and all of the things that it is funding. So I'm honored to be in that company, and I see my work as providing the story of the ideas behind this effort and how they have evolved over time, and also helping people to understand the mid-century Southern roots of all of this, that really the dream vision of this cause is, in a sense, to take us back to mid-century Virginia, I say, minus the segregation, and mid-century Virginia was the most oligarchic state in the country, with extreme voter suppression, extreme gerrymandering, you know, a parsimonious provision for public needs despite its wealth, starving public school system, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I have the story of the ideas and also of the legal angle, which is all important to understanding this, and also what the ultimate end game of these ideas is. So yes, I have been, many ordinary readers are connecting Jane Mayer and I in their communications, and I'm flattered by the connection.
Nancy, your book, Democracy Unchained, has become an intellectual flashpoint. And you've been subjected to a torrent of abuse for that. For example, I understand that Jonah Goldberg, a senior editor at the National Review, threatened you, writing that you should worry about the, quote, libertarian super posse on my ass. What is the method of operation of the right-wingers who are going after you?
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, I actually predicted in the book, I said, you know, in the later chapters, and I pointed to the case of Jane Mayer and climate scientists who have brought inconvenient truths to the public for this cause and been subjected to various efforts to smear them. So, you know, it's all... I felt that it was predictable and that I should anticipate it because this is how this cause plays, and their willingness to abuse power is part of my thesis. So, in a sense, they're confirming it. But still, it is pretty stunning to see how deeply the contemporary right has degraded our public discourse, you know, in quotes like the one that you read, you know, coming from the senior editor of a you know, widely read publication. And it's also kind of shocking how intellectually irresponsible so many are, in the sense that most of the people who started critiquing my book, by their own admission, had not read the book. they had read something, they'd found one piece that they might know about to try to, you know, impugn my credibility. So, to be honest, I don't really take them that seriously. I think they're proving to the American people the thesis that I argue in the book about how anti-democratic this cause is, and I'm much more engaged with the real readers who have responded so well to the book and to the, you know, various kinds of mainstream publications, from The Atlantic to The Guardian to Slate to New Republic to I can't even keep track of them all, Alternate, you know, many others have actually, their reviewers have read the book, engaged the book, and been excited by it, and those are the people I really care to reach and to talk with.
Nancy, James Buchanan actually traveled to Chile after the military coup in 1973 to advise General Augusto Pinochet's military dictatorship after the Chilean military, with instigation and aid from the American government, overthrew the democratically elected government of socialist Salvador Allende. Buchanan helped with suggestions on the economy and on how the dictatorship's constitution could be change so that it would make it very hard to abolish some of the clauses in the Constitution that enshrined private property. Do the far-right Republicans today want to change the American Constitution?
Yes, I believe that they do. And, yeah, it's very interesting. When Milton Friedman went, you know, the Nixon administration was still in power, and the Nixon administration had aided in the coup. By the time that James Buchanan went, people had carried out an assassination in the streets of Washington, D.C. It was an international pariah. The news of the brutality of the dictatorship had become common knowledge, and it was in that point in 1980 that Buchanan went to advise on this new constitution with which the dictatorship could get the radical changes that it wanted, had effected while under a military junta, so it could get those radical changes perpetuated after a transition to civilian rule, which the whole international community was pushing for. So Buchanan's contribution was arguably much more permanent and lasting and chilling in my mind. In any event, yes, the perceived success that the right enjoyed in Chile, and particularly, again, this neoliberal, if you want to call them right, I call them the property supremacist right, you can think about them in different ways, but they were pleased by what happened in Chile, and that is absolutely what they're trying to bring to the United States and, frankly, to other parts of the world as well. Buchanan said at one point that no constitution in the world protected the rights of the minority, and by that he always really meant the wealthy minority, adequately. And by that measure, all existing constitutions are failures. Now, you got to think about that. No place in the world captures your ideal. So this is like a radical utopian libertarian right, but because of this billionaire power that is behind it and its capacity to hire, literally thousands of operatives to move this agenda, it is on the verge of radically transforming our institutions and our legal system. So yes, they have invested mightily in changing the law through the various, the kind of law and economics programs to undermine the case for regulation, through investing in constitutional scholars who would want to bring us back to, what legal scholars would call the Lochner era, what I also remember as the Plessy era, a time of extreme dominance of capital and extreme suppression of democracy. And they are beginning to achieve that bit by bit around the country. They're talking about putting, voter ID in the federal constitution, putting balanced budget amendments in the federal constitution so as to undermine, programs like Social Security and Medicare. You can just go on. I mean, they have at least 10 different amendments that they want to get through if they get this constitutional convention. And because of their control over state, so many state governments, while the eyes of the left were focused on Washington and various personalities, because of that structural power, they are, by their own lights, close to success.
I think that the other alarming success they've had is within the legal system and the kind of judges that they're getting appointed, the last one being Neil Gorsuch. But if they stack that, then we're really in trouble.
And can I just add, Michael, that was actually a product of the Federalist Society, who groomed students for decades, conservative, to have them placed in judicial positions and higher up positions.
And you won't be surprised to know at this point that Koch was an early funder of that effort.
Exactly.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, and has funded the Institute for Justice and a lot of these organizations that seem so marginal in their legal thinking that I think many legal scholars don't take them seriously. But again, because of the power they've achieved and the fact that they've been able to get cases to the Supreme Court and score some significant victories, they are really important to watch. And another thing, actually, that I think is important for people to know is that this Koch-led libertarian cause is also working to politicize judicial elections and to pump unheard-of amounts of cash into state judicial races to ensure that the state courts sign off on the radical changes that they're making in policies in states like, again, my own North Carolina. So, again, this is highly strategic. It is very well thought out. There are people playing a long game with a very frightening end game, and it behooves all of us to understand it as best we can.
I wanted to ask you, on a personal note, if we might, how did you get political, and how would you define your politics?
Well, I got political. I was born in 1959, and so I was a child, you know, when the civil rights movement was on television and the war in Vietnam was on television, and I was a reader, and so I was always, you know, moved by things. But my first activism was in college when apartheid was in place in South Africa, and there was an anti-apartheid movement on campuses, and that was the first thing that really made me wake up and say, wow, this is wrong, you know, I need to do something. So I've always, you know, been a progressive person. I believe in democracy deeply. I believe in fairness, and that keeps me going and connecting to people who are also working for those things through writing this book has just been a source of joy. I mean, I can't tell you how many great people in the trenches or who are starting to pay attention to politics who hadn't before and who are reading the book and writing to me, how energizing that is. I feel like there's a great kind of weariness in America right now, I think, with people having felt bullied and having felt like their system is changing and it's not responsive and they don't understand why. And as they start to understand what's happening and why, more and more people are finding ways to get involved and to try to challenge this and to reverse this. And so that's just been really exciting to me. I just love to see grassroots leadership and people finding their voices. That's very sustaining for me.
Very moving, Nancy. Nancy McLean has written a wonderful book, which we heartily recommend to you, called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America. Nancy, it's just a tremendous contribution you've made. Heidi and I are grateful to you, and we've loved this interview, and we wish you all the luck. Are you going to be on tour? How do people get in touch with you so that we can know if you're speaking somewhere and people can come out and hear you?
Oh, thank you so much. And it has been such a pleasure talking to you guys. You have such an amazing show. If people go to the Penguin Random House book page for Democracy in Chains, they'll see a little orange logo that says On Tour, and the tour spots are starting to be put in there. And it's not a full listing yet, you know, so if you don't see your city represented, you could contact the press or contact me and see if anything is being organized there. But at this point, I'd say we have a couple dozen venues and places in the works, and so hopefully I'll get to an area where I can talk to some of your wonderful listeners.
Nancy, it's been an honor to have you on. Congratulations on a truly remarkable and timely book, Democracy in Chains.
Thank you so much, Heidi, and thank you, Michael.
You take it easy.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. In 1947, Congress passed the National Security Act, which led to formation of the National Security Council and, under its direction, the CIA. Its original mandate was to collect and analyze strategic information for use in war. Though shrouded in secrecy, many CIA activities, such as covert military and cybersecurity operations, have drawn considerable public scrutiny and criticism. In 1948, the Security Council approved a secret directive, NSC 10-2, authorizing the CIA to carry out an array of covert operations. This essentially allowed the CIA to become a paramilitary organization. Before he died, George F. Kennan, the diplomat and Cold War strategist who sponsored the directive, said that, quote, "In light of latter history, it was the greatest mistake I ever made." Since NSC 10-2 authorized violation of international law, it also established an official policy of lying to cover up the lawbreaking.
We speak today with Douglas Valentine, author of The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. Mr. Valentine's rare access to CIA officials has resulted in portions of his research materials being archived at the National Security Archive, Texas Tech University's Vietnam Center, and John Jay College. He has written 3 books on CIA operations, including The Phoenix Program, which documented the CIA's elaborate system of population surveillance, control, entrapment, imprisonment, torture, and assassination in Vietnam. His new book describes how many of these practices remain operational today. Doug Valentine, welcome to Law and Disorder. Douglas Valentine, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me as your guest.
Doug, how did you come to get such unparalleled access to top-level CIA agents, including Director Bill Colby?
Well, I'm not really sure of the answer. I was a nobody. You know, I hadn't gone to Columbia Journalism School. In fact, I was a college dropout. And I had written a book about my father and his experiences in World War II. And I wanted to write a book about the Vietnam War. And so I sent this book that I wrote about my father called The Hotel Talk Logan to Colby. And he read it. And based on him reading this book I wrote about my father, he agreed to do an interview with me about the CIA's Phoenix program. But I really just stumbled into it. And I think that the reasons that Colby talked to me and then introduced me to a lot of other CIA officers are complex. And I think a lot of it has to do with the psychology of the country at the time. That was in 1984 and what was known as the generation gap. But I'm not exactly sure why, but it did happen. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that I just had the audacity to approach Colby and ask him to help me write a book about the Phoenix program, which nobody else had done at that time.
Doug, the book that you wrote, The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam, is considered by many the definitive study of the CIA's secretive counterinsurgency program during the war in Vietnam. One CIA officer called it the greatest blackmail scheme ever invented. What do you mean by that?
Well, it meant that the Phoenix program was targeted against civilians. The civilians who managed the insurgency in South Vietnam. Not soldiers, not even guerrillas or terrorists, but these were civilians who were working undercover in political positions, generally speaking, to manage the insurgency in South Vietnam, and their names could be put on blacklists. And once their name was on, once somebody had informed about them and said that they were a member of this, what was called the Viet Cong infrastructure, the insurgency, then the CIA and its forces could go out and kidnap them, put them in interrogation centers, kill them along with their families, do anything they wanted to try and suppress them. And the problem was that lots of innocent civilians got their names put on these blacklists. In fact, one of the ways that the CIA and its forces in the South Vietnamese Special Police and its mercenary army, one of the ways that they got people to inform on the members of the Viet Cong insurgency was by threatening to put their names on blacklists. So therefore, it became a blackmail scheme that if you were just an average citizen and you did not support the government of South Vietnam, you could find your name on a blacklist and your whole family could be wiped out. So it became a way of not just attacking the members of this Viet Cong infrastructure, but a way of population control, a way of terrorizing everybody in South Vietnam and bringing them all into line following government policies. And the minute you stepped out of line, you could find your name on a blacklist.
A common theme is the CIA's ability to deceive and propagandize the American public through its impenetrable government-sanctioned shield of official secrecy and plausible deniability. Can you give us some examples of this, please, Doug?
Of plausible deniability?
Yes.
Well, first of all, one of the CIA officers that William Colby referred me to directly was a man named Tom Donahue. Tom Donahue was a veteran CIA officer. He had run the CIA's covert action branch in South Vietnam from 1964 to 1966. And then he later went on to join what was called the Vietnam Task Force. He was a very senior officer, and Colby arranged for me to have an interview with him. And in that interview, Donahue told me that the CIA never launched a covert action program unless it met two criteria. The first criteria was that it had to have some intelligence potential. It had to have some value to the CIA. And the second thing, it had to be deniable. The CIA does not launch any kind of program at all unless it's deniable. And it does this in a thousand different ways. I mean, you could, you know, I spent hours talking to Donahue about all the different ways that they do it. But the most common way of the CIA launching a covert action program that's deniable is by attributing it to another agency. They say the State Department is doing this, or they say the military is doing this, or they say a non-governmental organization like Amnesty International is doing this, or they say another country is doing it. They might say that the secret services of the government of Ukraine are conducting a particular operation, when actually it's the CIA that's conducting the operation and controlling the Ukraine security forces and paying their salaries and directing them where to go. So there's just a million different ways that the CIA does create plausible deniability for it, and of course at every step of the way they have the help of the American media, which is in a partnership with the CIA. The major newspapers and TV organizations never report about the CIA. And, you know, I mean, we're supposed to live in a democracy, and the media, especially investigative reporters, are supposed to be out there looking out for our interests and telling us what's really happening. But, of course, they don't do that. And what's really happening, the most important things that are happening and shaping our democracy, are the CIA's covert actions, which are all deniable and never reported on. So we hear, you know, mere civilians in the United States really never know what's going on.
Doug, in your book, The CIA as Organized Crime, you lay out some of the most egregious acts of the agency. What do you think are one or two of the worst?
Oh, you know, that's so hard to say, but it's certainly conducting paramilitary wars in foreign countries. For example, in Laos, the CIA organized an entire army of mountain tribes. They're sometimes called the Mios, and they're sometimes called the Hmong. Laos was supposed to be a country that was neutral, but the CIA organized an entire secret army of this tribe of Hmong natives. Most of the soldiers were children, young boys, 14, 15, 16 years old. And they sent thousands and thousands of these young boys to their death in, you know, trying to stop the Viet Cong from coming down the Ho Chi Minh trails through Laos. They just used this mountain tribe as expendable cannon fodder. And they do this sort of thing all over the world all the time. They've done it in Iraq. They've done it in Afghanistan. They do it in numerous countries throughout Africa, where they just organize militias and secret armies, and nobody ever reports. It's send tens of thousands of these people to their deaths. There's never any price to pay for it. So for me, of all the many, many things they do, including torture and blackmail and even infiltrating various agencies of the U.S. government and using them for their own purposes, as conducting of secret wars and sacrificing young foreign citizens that really strikes me as the worst thing.
How does the CIA dominate branches of the U.S. government like the Drug Enforcement Agency and the State Department?
Under what's called national security laws and this, a clause that was included in the National Security Directive of, I think it was December 1947, which gives the CIA the right to do, the president direct the CIA to do whatever is necessary in the interests of national security. Therefore, they can infiltrate any agency of the government and assign positions in that agency, for example, the Drug Enforcement Administration, to CIA officers, so that CIA officers can make sure that the foreign operations that the DEA is conducting, or the foreign operations that U.S. Customs, or even the FBI, certainly the military are conducting, are not infiltrated by foreign agents, or in case of the DEA, that actual drug traffickers that are working for the CIA aren't arrested. It's a way for the infiltrating the DEA allows the CIA to control the drug business around the world, which is really important for the United States and has been, since before the CIA was created, when the United States was supporting the nationalist Chinese in China in the 1930s, the way the nationalist Chinese supported themselves was through opium revenues. And so the United States government allowed Chiang Kai-shek and his Kuomintang government to traffic in narcotics so they could support themselves. And the United States does that with various governments around the world, even to today, such as in Afghanistan, where the people who support the United States and its operations against the Taliban are often drug trafficking warlords, who again, in exchange for lucrative contracts, the right to build airports or construction contracts, ante up young soldiers and in return, who are sent to their death by the scores, by the hundreds, by the thousands. In exchange, these warlords are allowed to traffic narcotics. That's basically how the CIA does business around the world, and it's not just through the DEA. It's through every United States agency, U.S. agency that operates overseas. They all are subservient to the CIA, and the CIA has what's called cognizance over their operations and basically complete control of them.
We're speaking with Douglas Valentine, who wrote the book, The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. Doug, what influence has the CIA's activities had on social and political movements abroad and in the United States?
Sure. This is one of the primary covert operations of the CIA. It's basically the essence of its mandate is to, through sabotage and propaganda, control political and social movements in foreign countries. And they do this in a variety of ways. It's been standard practice and sort of like the driving principle since after World War II. If I can just give a little background. After World War II, the communists had really been formed the underground forces of resistance against the Nazis in France and Italy and a couple of other European nations. And so immediately after World War II, communist parties became politically influential, and I'll just focus on France and Italy, and they all of a sudden were in control of the governments. And the CIA could not fight wars against France and Italy, so they developed a program called Courting the Compatible Left. In order to get France and Italy away from communism, they supported the Social Democrats, people who were hardcore communists, but people who were willing to work with capitalists, which of course is the driving, accept American aid and work with the Americans. And so this became a very subtle way of, the CIA resorted to very subtle ways of luring hardcore communists away from communism into social democratic movements. And this began to bloom and blossom all across the world as a sort of a standard operating procedure. When it was necessary, when the communists were intractable, then the CIA would do such things as hire Corsican gangsters, which they did in Marseille and right after World War II, to break up communist strikes. But generally speaking, they tried to do this through subtle forms of propaganda, blackmail, bribery, sabotage, and methods like that. There's a pretty good book about that by it's a war about how the CIA waged cultural war in the 1950s and 1960s, and the role that a lot of Americans played, people like Gloria Steinem, other intellectuals in the United States, who actually helped the CIA in this effort to lure people out of the Communist Party into social democratic movements.
Doug, let's talk about the class origins of the CIA. Who does it really represent in the United States of America? Is it the establishment?
Well, yeah, certainly the CIA is not a social services organization, okay? Its mandate does not state that it should help poor people in the United States, okay? Its mandate is that it should protect the national security of the United States. And by definition, that means the people who actually own the industries and infrastructure, the banking system, the individuals who actually own the United States, the people who are millionaires and billionaires, the people who can be said to employ big corporations who employ thousands of Americans. That's what's meant by national security, is supporting those corporations and the people that actually, the Wall Street investment bankers, that faction of the United States. And when the OSS, which is the predecessor organization, the Office of Strategic Services, was formed in 1942 by President Roosevelt, the person he went to was a man named William Donovan, who'd been a World War I veteran and was a U.S. attorney in Buffalo and elsewhere. And Donovan actually went to all the elite people from the Ivy League colleges, from industry, and those individuals were all given the management positions in the OSS. And when the CIA was created, all those people from, the upper crust, the OSS was also often called social. It was the foxtrot crowd from Georgetown. All those people went in and took over all the management positions in the CIA. This does not mean that the CIA does not hire people from all ethnicities, translators who speak unusual languages, and that somebody from Jacksonville, Florida, who plays football, or some guy from Texas, or who's a football player, can't get into the CIA and into its paramilitary division. What it means is that all the important decisions and all the management and the executive positions are filled by people from the upper class, and they know perfectly well that their job is to protect the interests of the major corporations and banking institutions, and like I said, the people who actually own America. That's what national security is.
And what is the CIA's relationship with Donald Trump? Is it independent from him?
Well, I don't exactly know. It's been theorized that when Trump was in trouble, financially in trouble, and that he needed an influx of capital, money, and he went to Deutsche Bank and massive loans were forthcoming to him, that the CIA may have had some hand in that, that the money that was coming to him from Russian oligarchs, who were basically mafia characters in the Soviet Union, had just collapsed, and the CIA wanted to, again, control political social movements in Russia, and of course it gravitated towards the wealthiest people, and it had tried to establish wealthy people in Russia who were beholden to it, the CIA and the United States government, that the CIA may have arranged for some of these Russian oligarchs to launder their money, their ill-gotten money, to Donald Trump through Deutsche Bank. Trump, being a greedy guy who never thinks beyond the minute, may have been unwitting, you know, as to the source of where this money was coming from. You know, somebody might have said to him, Donald, why don't you go to Deutsche Bank? I think you can get a deal there. And just being a greedy guy who lives in the moment, you know, he did it, and the money was forthcoming. And so he could have been an unwitting recipient of dirty money. That's a theory that's floating around. And if it's true, then no, the Mueller investigation and no other kind of investigation that was ever launched in the United States would ever reveal it, because no investigation is ever allowed to reveal the CIA's hand. You know, so in a sense, Trump would be a protected person forever. If anybody read the Trump, the Mueller report, you'll see that the CIA is never mentioned. There's a reason for that. You know, these things come to us. People say that, you know, William Barr scripted it or somebody else scripted it, but you just never read about, you don't read about the CIA in the New York Times either. I mean, you just don't read about it. And it's because secrecy dominates our society. Secrecy dominates our culture. It dominates the world. And especially, it dominates us through the secret of how we're dominated. And none of that is ever revealed. And if it was to be revealed, you know, and we were all to understand how the CIA operates and how it actually controls the information that we receive, then there would be, you know, a total disruption, upheaval in American society. So it just never happens.
How can listeners read more about what you've done? And your body of work on the CIA is really magnificent. Do you have a website?
Yes, I do. DouglasValentine.com, which lists all my books. Plus, if you go to Google, all the books just, you know, and you punch my name in, then I'm usually the first Douglas Valentine that comes up. And there's a, you know, Google has all my books listed. And at this point, there's like 8 or 9 of them. I can't remember anymore.
Thank you so much for being on with us today. And we hope to stay in touch as future political developments unravel.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.